I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and this is Ferguson and Beyond, continuing the community conversation. Today, we'll hear the second hour of a town hall meeting recorded Monday night at Wellspring Church in Ferguson.
We are pleased now to be joined by two additional members of the panel. This is not a political statement. On my left is Rich McClure. He has extensive experience working with communities and state and local governments on complex issues of education, government organization, and public policy that has prepared him for this effort. He is co-chairing the Ferguson Commission. He's the chairman of the St. Louis Regional Board of Teach for America. He's a member and former president of Civic Progress. That's an organization of leaders from the region's largest employers. He's the former president of Unigroup, Inc., and he's held a number of public policy leadership positions in Missouri and Illinois, and he was appointed, as I mentioned, by Missouri Governor Jay Nixon in November to lead the Ferguson Commission. There are two chairs of this commission. And also here with us now is Brittany Pecknett. She's Executive Director of Teach for America in St. Louis, a position she's held since 2012. She previously worked as a legislative assistant for the U.S. House of Representatives and was a third grade teacher in Southeast Washington, D.C., as a member of Teach for America Corps. And of all of those jobs, I know that was the hardest.
Absolutely.
And she was also appointed to the Ferguson Commission by Missouri Governor Jay Nixon in November and to President Barack Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing in December. Thank you both so much for joining us. And we know that you are coming directly from a meeting of the Ferguson Commission, so we appreciate your taking the time. Also remaining with us, Reverend Willis Johnson, Chris Kramer, State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, and DeRay McKesson. So while you're here, how's the commission work going?
Thanks so much for having me. It's really an honor, and I would add to my overly long biography, I apologize, that I'm a proud member of the peaceful protest community here and have remained so even after becoming a member of these commissions and task forces. And so for me, I am pleased to see that the conversation has not just kind of moved into one siloed area. We were just at a working group meeting addressing very specifically issues of law enforcement and community relations. And we had folks from the protest community there. We had young folks there. We had community leaders there. We had law enforcement there. So I am pleased to say that as the work progresses, we continue to see people of all stripes engage, because that's the only way we're actually going to move forward.
I was asking earlier if folks were encouraged or discouraged. Do you mind if I ask you that?
I remain encouraged not because of processes, but because of people. And so every time I get out there onto South Florissant or West Florissant or go into a school and hear young people talking about this and saying, I'm absolutely going to continue to make my voice heard, and you, Commissioner Lady, here's what you need to be doing, that kind of accountability and continued push is what actually gives me hope, right? So the process is going to be as good as we make it, but I have consistent hope in people because people keep showing up. People kept showing up here tonight. And people keep showing up to have the conversations and make sure that we don't have a 2015 like we had a 2014.
Mm-hmm. Rich McClure.
First of all, thank you for including me as well. I'm pleased to join the other panelists and Brittany here with you. This is, I think, a moment for our community that we have to realize is ours to seize. And so I am encouraged as well. But I'm encouraged because of groups like this that come together tonight in this kind of a crowd. Because we hear at the commission from people of goodwill who want things to be better, who want things to change, and their voices are being heard. This is a long process, but is a process that must continue to have momentum and push and a degree of intensity and a degree of intentionality from across our entire community. And the young lady who just spoke, I think, is a great example. We heard at our youth summit from a number of young people who say, we want things to change. And when we aren't hearing enough conversation, that bothers us. And that, to me, is encouraging.
Before you came, the question that I was asking was about people who say they're sick of it and they don't want to hear about it anymore. Are you hearing that?
You know, to a degree. But, you know, if you start to peel the onion back and you start the did you know questions. So the commission put out a 100-day report a couple of weeks ago. And it was intended to say we need to confront our reality. And here's what we've learned from the community, from research, from data over the last 100 days. And when you start talking about poverty and about police-citizen interactions that come through municipal court practices and educational disparities, pretty soon people start to say, you know what, I'm beginning to understand that these are region-wide systemic issues.
Okay. Are you encouraged or discouraged?
I'm also encouraged, and for much the same reasons as Brittany is. I'm encouraged because people are coming to the table and saying we need to deal with these issues.
Let's keep hearing from more folks in our audience. And you are Jerry? Jerry Jasper, thanks for joining us. What's on your mind?
I'm Jerry Jasper, and I protested from the very beginning. I have my sign in the car, Truth, Justice, and Peace in Ferguson. I was raised to respect everybody. I taught at Flow Valley. My brother-in-law is black. My step-nephew was shot and killed July 24, 2010, in the city by another black man. But my problem is the detectives do not call my brother-in-law back. So I understand about people not respecting people. What I think has to happen is we have to space it up. I go to the city council meeting, I say, anything hidden should be revealed. We can't pretend like it's all somebody else. We have to work together. And I have friends, they're tired of it too. Well, some days I cry when I see what's happening because I live two blocks from the police station. The hate and anger people have for each other, it breaks my heart because I try to treat everybody the same. Malcolm X said, truth is truth, no matter who's saying it. Justice is justice. We have to do it right. We can't pretend like it's not existing, and we also can't expect for it instantly to go away. And sometimes it hurts. I get out of my comfort zone. I was down there Saturday when the big march was there. Some people know me. There's protesters that know me. They know I'm the real deal.
Well, Jerry, you're leading me to something I wanted to talk about, so thank you for coming. Some people have brought up policies and systems that need to change. Other people are bringing up personal relations that they feel need to change. What do you think?
I think right's right and wrong's wrong. If there's policies that are wrong, they need to change. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean we throw everything out. Not every policeman's bad. Not every teacher's good. So things need to change. And then people need to change. We have to accept God made everybody. We can't say, well, you're poor, or you're this, and you're gay, and you're this, and you're that. No. We just love everybody. It's not my job. I'm not called to clean people up and straighten them up. I'm just called to love them and look at my part. Sometimes the biggest problem, look in the mirror. We're looking at the problem.
All right. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. What about that? Who wants to jump in on this? Brittany, do you want to jump in? I'm interested in this question of whether you think the major issue confronting us, and you can take that us any way you want, as a community or as a country, is it personal relationships, that people are segregated, they don't know each other, or is it that systems are broken and flawed? What do you think?
Yes.
That was Chris.
Okay. It's like Jeopardy.
You know, it's interesting, the question about whether or not systems are broken and flawed, I respectfully reject the premise because I think actually a lot of the systems that are at play right now are working exactly as they were designed to. That's the reason why I work in public education. So the history in this city, right, we don't even have to look at the entire country, this city of housing discrimination that would lead to employment discrimination that ensured that certain kids got a good education and certain kids got a bad education was by design in order to retain power in certain communities and restrict power in other communities. And so I think that to ignore the systemic question and only have a conversation about relationships is to, quite frankly, let ourselves off the hook and won't actually lead to any real change, because this isn't just about bad apples or bad actors. This is actually about systems that perpetuate bad actions. And so ensuring that we get underneath what's behind those systems and what created them to create equitable systems is actually the work that we need to do. We have to leverage relationships to make that change, but ultimately this is a conversation about systems.
Before you got here, DeRay McKesson, one of the points that he was making is that he feels that the police department really needs to be disbanded here. Am I accurately representing your point of view?
I think that's one thing.
That's one thing. But he says that the police department needs to be disbanded. And is that because you feel that there are just too many people with their individual fiefdoms all trying to generate revenue, or you think that it's just the culture is broken, it can't be fixed? Do you think all of them around here do, or just this particular one? And because you are tasked with making recommendations, I want to know your perspective on that. What about it?
I think that, like, what Brittany hinted to is totally right, right? This idea that, like, systems and structures sort of shape the way some people act and shape the way people experience, like, large parts of the world. I think that what we've seen with the Ferguson Police Department is that, A, the DOJ said it, which convinced a lot of people that it is, like, at the root, right? It's not about bad apples, right? It's, like, a bad crop, right? Like, something is just wrong. And we have seen this system interact with people so dangerously and so violently just since August, right? I mean, before August was really bad, and that was the DOJ. Since August continues to be bad, right? So I think that's how I feel about the DOJ. And to the systemic thing is that, like, I do agree with Brittany about, like, just focusing on people's relationships is not necessarily the easier work, but it is the work that doesn't spread as much. And when you change like fines and fees, it changes the way that whole swaths of people interact with systems. When you put accountability measures in place where like there's a special prosecutor, things like that is like getting to a sense of justice that like more people can experience, because people experience systems and structures in groups.
I see. Are you prepared to give an opinion about this whole question of the municipal police force and whether it should be disbanded or not? Do you have an opinion about that?
I think I'm still developing an opinion on it, because I want to make sure, especially engaging in this task force process and this commission process, we've been getting a lot of information about it. What I will say is that whatever the setup looks like, accountability must be urgent and swift in whatever the setup is, right? And I think ultimately that's what we are talking about, right? So that it is A, not possible to proactively inflict injustice on people, and B, if you are found guilty of inflicting injustice upon masses of people, that pretty urgently you are brought to a level of accountability. And so whatever the setup is, I think that needs to be the name of the game.
As we did last time, we've invited reporters from St. Louis Public Radio to join us, both to add their insights from people who've been covering the story consistently and also add their specific insights based on their beats. Jason Rosenbaum is here. Emmanuel Berry is here. Welcome them, please. Thank you. They've been here.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction.
Jason, and also we've been live blogging this event and getting your emails and tweets. And so, Jason, you feel there's something you want to jump in on at this point?
Yeah, there's one thing that I wanted to just mention and then ask the panel about, because there's been this kind of drumbeat within especially the national media about how there's this desire to dissolve the Ferguson Police Department and replace it specifically with St. Louis County. First of all, I was talking with the senator the other day. She doesn't support that idea. She would rather certain municipalities take over, from what I recall. And both Joe Manny's and I spoke with every city council candidate, which runs the gamut from people like Brian Fletcher of I Love Ferguson fame to Bob Hudgens, who's part of the protest community. And none of them support disbanding the police department and replace them with St. Louis County. So my question to the panel is, there are obviously a lot of people that want to see that happen, but if it conflicts with the policymakers that are actually going to make that decision, is that going to lead to disappointment, or is that just lead to trying to engage them to try a different alternative?
Who should answer that? To the state senator? Who should answer that?
I mean, anybody from DeRay to the state senator.
Senator, I would like to be – I'm interested in your perspective on that. You do not favor disbanding
the
municipal department.
Absolutely not.
Tell me.
I actually do support the disbandment of the police department. When it comes to St. Louis County taking over, I am absolutely opposed to that. They are part of the injury. They are absolutely part of the injury. They are no different than what happened. When you reflect on the first month period, it was the decision of St. Louis County to injure my constituents and people who are in the area. They are the ones who called my citizens animals and monkeys. We have that on video. On August 11th, the first day of tear gassing, when I was with 100, 150 of my constituents and tear gassed for 3.5 hours on a one-way street, it was St. Louis County who were there at that QT. They're the ones who had their masks. They're the ones who created arbitrary rules, which are expressed in Mustafa versus St. Louis County. They lost. They're the ones who created the 5-second rules.
So how should it be handled then? Do you think you should reconstitute it from the ground up? It should be disbanded and then reconstituted? What's your idea?
Well, one, I want to respond to Jason and say that it may not be up to the elected people. It may be up to the Department of Justice. So they may, if they do not follow the guidelines and some of the ideas expressed by DOJ, it won't be up to them. The other thing I would say is, when you are in a situation that is so much bigger than this town, than this region, than this state, this is a national crisis. This is an area where literally black men have been allowed to die. It is a socially accepted genocide. In America, what is going on right now is a genocide, and there are certain things that are not going to flow like some people want. There are some things that have happened that I haven't desired. There are a lot of people out there who are going to meet wins and be really satisfied with certain wins, and then there are some people who have been part of the status quo who are totally uncomfortable. totally uncomfortable. And they may be part of the reason why there's not going to be a Ferguson. I don't know the answer. I don't know, but I do not support St. Louis County taking over because they're part of the problem. And number two, I think that we do need to start all over again because this region needs to start all over again. We have swept the dust under the rug literally for decades, and it's time to stop.
Thank you, Jason. Can we hear from Laura McLaughlin?
I'm probably one of the people you were talking about, the fatigue. I came tonight because I thought I was starting to feel fatigue and stopped hearing things. So coming tonight was, again, opening my ears. So thank you for that. My question for you is, I agree with Mr. McKesson, there's not going to be a simple end to this. Unfortunately, I wish there was. I'm looking for milestones. What milestone can I put my hat on to feel good about some progress? Is it municipal court reform? Is it your theater? Is it educating the children to be more respectful and equal? What can I put my hat on? Because I need to put my hat on something for a little bit to feel good.
Okay. Reverend Johnson?
I offered a suggestion to our mayor the last time we was here, and I simply asked him to acknowledge and to say on behalf of the city and leadership, I'm sorry. And to date, we have still not gotten an apology. We've still not gotten a full acknowledgement of the reality that is this community. This report after report continues to push people to places where they are more committed to protecting their interests and their perspective than providing leadership. I don't know what it takes for a sunset law to be truly honored and enacted. I don't know how much more transparency or what the definition is of transparency other than showing up, speaking up, standing up. But I think one milestone is if we can get to a place as a community to acknowledge that some trauma has occurred that still exists and that we are not politically scripted, well manicured and structured around everything other than saying I'm sorry, and that we're going to work together to honestly and earnestly address real concern amongst ourselves, we can't move forward. We're going to continue to be in the place that we're at. And I know that some people say you're taking steps backwards, but everyone else around us in the municipalities, in the county, in the state, in the nation is willing to say something ain't right here, except the leadership of this community, specifically 63135.
Duray McKesson.
I will say I like love your question, right? Because I'm with you. I do think there's this interesting thing about how do we frame it in a way that acknowledges that the solution will not be the solutions will not be simple, but also allow people to experience success, right? And keep fighting. I think that's real. I do think when I think about the arc of the protest, it was at the beginning, it was this idea of like, we will not be silent and we will just tell our truth. And that was like the whole, it was like confront, disrupt, and that was truth telling. And then it was like that plus this really intentional community building. It was like creating spaces where people came together to be together differently and to talk about policy and to talk about protest actions and just to be organized differently. And I do think we're starting to get to a place where we can think about what does it mean to be in a decentralized space where people are fighting differently, and that is important and good in terms of how we think about it, and how do we like get all of the ways that people think about the win, how do we put them in a place where people can like digest them and sort of internalize them? I don't think we figured it out yet, but I think we know that that is the next part of the work.
How about voting? How about getting people to vote?
Voting is an important part of the work, right?
But I thought you were going to say it's overrated.
Yeah, I mean,
I was going to fight with you.
I would just say that like voting, that was what they fought for in the civil rights movement, and we're still here, right? So people have voted. Voting in and of itself doesn't change systems and structures like at the root. Yeah. Voting is like one way to get there. And voting, you know, I do think part of this voting conversation is like victim blaming, right? It's like, why didn't you choose the better leader who was going to not cause trauma to you? And in places like this, it's like the town manager, you know, he wasn't elected, but he had like considerable influence. So,
well, how does he get his job? I mean, he's not elected, but he's picked by the people.
But this is the challenge, and I'm sorry, Brother D.
Go ahead.
This is the
Reverend
challenge
Johnson.
With the, I'm all for the electoral process, and we need to register folk and the people to go and dig deeply. The issue here is not whether or not we actually have registered voters. People need to get up off their seat and go vote in this community. But we need to add to that. The challenge is how do you just simply, you know, changing the guard, changing the faces in the composite is not the sole answer. We have elected people who, when they get into the system, then get into groupthink. Because now, because I am a board member and I carry the liability or the weight of the municipality, now I cluster and I get in collective thought and action. Because again, it's about self-preservation, whether it's saving my term or preserving my space. And this is not an indictment on anyone, but when you get into those kind of situations where it is assimilation, and unless you're a strong-willed person, like some people on this panel sometimes, and it gets you in trouble.
I'm not saying you're dismissive, but I often feel that people are dismissive of people say, well, people need to change their hearts and minds. They're dismissive of that. But then if you say, well, you got to vote and change the people, the actors, they're dismissive of that. What's the answer?
And I will quickly just say that I think voting is a part of the solution. I think the way that people talk about voting is if it is the game changer, right? And I just don't think that's real. I think that the system shouldn't kill you whether you vote or not.
What's the game changer?
Well, I, you know,
so I'll toss it to Brittany around systemic change.
No. No, keep it. What's the game changer?
No, the preface of this is I think we need to push ourselves to think about winning differently. And the win is not one thing, and that's what I'm saying, is that I think it can be as simple or as small as new training programs and body cameras for some people and 15,000 other things that will actually get to the root cause. And voting can be one of those things. I'm all about that. When I feel confronted with the voting problem, people think if black people voted more differently, better, excitedly, whatever, insert here, then the police would stop killing us. And that just isn't true. That is not true. And I think that is this really subtle victim blaming. You didn't vote, so they can just kill you, right? That's the undertone of how I think people offer that. And I think that is insulting. I think it's offensive. And I think that we saw the civil rights movement, that alone is not the win. That desegregation and the Voting Rights Act didn't change the fact that we are on a panel because the police are killing people. You know what I mean?
Okay, Brittany, then Rich, sure. And then Senator, I know you want back in.
I think my answer goes in a lot of ways back to Jason's question, because what we can't do is just change around the chairs on the deck and pretend we're in a totally different place suddenly. We actually have to set a different standard that is so clear and that people power is so clearly attached to that nobody would dare occupy any kind of elected or appointed position in any of our communities without abiding by it, right? So for me, the win is if you are a city councilor, an alderman, a mayor, a city manager, if somebody hired you, if somebody voted for you, that you are so clear that the people will shut you down if you don't get it right, that you behave that way permanently, right? If you behave that way through the arc of your public service, that for me is the win, right? And that doesn't just have to do with how we vote people in. That also has to do with how we hold them accountable once we vote them in, mm-hmm. that they can't escape this accountability right here in this moment while we're sitting here. And that they're required to be fully present. And Pastor Johnson understands what I'm saying. That they're required to be fully present in moments like this.
I do too, by the way.
And so setting an actual standard and requiring everybody who comes into our public space and comes into our official spaces to abide by those, for me, is what actually makes voting a powerful thing. Because then I'm not just voting for six in one hand and half a dozen in the other. Then I'm actually voting for people who are fully accountable to me. And I think that one of the really powerful things that we've seen come out of Ferguson is that accountability will be had.
It will. You think it will. It will.
We're not going to go home, Michelle. We're not going to go home.
I think that is real.
We're not going home.
Rich, you want to jump in?
I think one of the challenges here is there is this kind of constant search for one game changer, right? And that just doesn't exist. And we should stop talking about it in those terms. I'd like to build on the comment made by the young lady just at the microphone, and that is this is a series of milestones. And we didn't get to the highest concentration of unaccredited school districts in the state in the North County area overnight, right? We got there with some very serious wrong policy decisions that got us to this point. So what does it take to get great school leaders and great teachers and great leadership in those school districts and turn them around? It takes a series of milestones over time. And every systemic issue, whether it's jobs or whether it's healthcare programs, is a series of milestones that we just have to tackle and address and move forward. And then the game will begin to change slowly.
Can I ask you this, Rich? I'm putting you on the spot. Do you feel that other white citizens agree with you about that? about the need to hang in there for the long haul? Because we keep hearing about how this is a racially polarized question, that a lot of the white citizens are over it and don't want to hear anymore, and that the African-American citizens are still engaged because this directly affects their lives. Can I put you on the spot
and ask you, is this
as racially polarized as we're hearing, or do other white citizens want to stay in the game?
I choose to believe that people of goodwill, once confronted with the facts and once they realize the gravity of the situation, that many will move and many will be a part of that change. Some will not. But many, many will. And we need to give them that opportunity and that vehicle in this moment with these voices raised to do that.
Do you mind if I go to another member of the audience for? Okay,
sure,
Tiffany, are you here? Tiffany Taylor? You had something you wanted to share. What's on your mind?
Do you think that the police should live within the community that they serve and protect?
Interesting. Senator, do you have an opinion about that?
I do. And have researched the issue before Mike Brown. There are, I want to say, two places in the state of Missouri that have a requirement for at least the chief of police. And then St. Louis City has its own version, seven and out. You serve 7 years in St. Louis City, and then you can move out. And I firmly believe in the experience that we have had in University City. When you have police officers who live in your community, they understand your community.
Do I have it right that University City is the most diverse police department in the state? Do I have that right?
In the state, I don't know. In the region, absolutely.
In the region, absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the view that I have of my police chief is by far different than what my view is of Chief Jackson. And I don't know what protocol they went through, but they did not even come and engage in the harassment of protesters. They refused to do that, my municipality. And I am so proud of them for that, because the multiple police jurisdictions that were here, multiple from St. Louis County, were very intimidating. They were very disrespectful. I wanted to go back to the other questions that were posed earlier, though. I believe, for one answer, to have change, it's not only going to be person by person, but it's going to be part of the system. I am part of the system, you know, and I want to be like Ronald Reagan said, tear down this wall. A success for me is to tear down the wall of racism, to tear it down, to change the system. I mean, what I'm encouraged by, what has impacted me as a lawmaker, is the fact that our Constitution was broken. It was not represented by everyone. Everyone didn't have that opportunity to get due process. The rules of the game changed. That's not right. The Constitution doesn't change. It doesn't decide on this block we're going to make sure everyone has a pathway to due process, but on this block we're going to make sure no one has a pathway to due process. It's wrong. So a success for me is to tear down those walls, to change the statutes. I wish that more people had an appreciation of the law and understood. We want to hear from you. We can't read your minds. I'm not reading your mind. I can't do that. I don't have that power to do that. But I sure as heck was on the street the first day. And I sure as heck held people as they were crying and engaging and was present. Not only present in the very early days, but started teaching, because education is the foundation of life. And it's not just for these kids. Another win, you asked a question earlier. If you phrased your question, how do you teach children to be respectful? How do you teach police officers to be respectful?
Do you think that's possible? I take it from your experience in University City that you do think it's possible to have law
Absolutely,
enforcement that's responsive.
We asked for it from the community. Like over 10 years ago, we had a program. I remember being a teenager. We had a program, literally, of young people who were engaged at the high school who would be like deputy police officers at our fair and square. They would do it all year long. We literally have officers who graduated from our local high school, and we look to those people. I mean, our police chief is part of that. We have women who are part of that. But we asked for that in U City. It was part of our evolution. We have had and still have racial problems. But part of the change that has occurred that we have realized is that we wanted a change. Even 5 or 6 years ago, we talked about the diversity of our police department and having more women. We now have way more women who are police officers because that's what we craved. That's what we were hungry for in our community.
Well, that was, in fact, one of the Department of Justice recommendations for this department, was that recruitment be both ethnically diverse and also recruit more women. We have one more question. Diana Oleskovich, what's on your mind?
I think what's on my mind is some of that same accountability that we've all been talking about, that the accountability is both the personal and the systemic, and that voters are as accountable as elected officials are, and power to the people, that if our elected officials don't. I'm a grandma. I am engaging in conversations. I think if you had asked me a year ago, I would have said I was educated and very conscious about race. And since Ferguson, I've done a radical change. Been on the street with DeRay and Brittany and grateful for those experiences. I think the pain and the difficulty has come from people who are close to me, other white folks who don't understand. Reading Shelley Tuchlach's book on witnessing whiteness and Debbie Irwin's book on waking up white have radically changed my view of life, and I think it is really important. I'm concerned. I live in the historic Shaw neighborhood where Von Derrick Myers was killed. I see his grandmother. I see his friends. Often the memorial is on a corner where I ride my bike all the time. I'm concerned about all those other young black men who are being killed in our city, and there's no accountability. I want to know when and where that accountability is coming. We talk about urgent, swift accountability, and we don't even know the names. That's my frustration and my pain.
Britton, Tacknett.
I really want to thank you for that question and comment, right? Because if we forget why we are here and for whom we are here, then this is all for naught and about our egos, right? And so we have to continue to name the names. We have to name the fact that in 7 months, we lost seven young black men to police-involved shootings in St. Louis alone, right? And so we can name Tamir Rice. We have to name Eric Gardner. We have to name Tanisha Anderson. We have to name Ezell Ford. But we also have to name the six others that came after Mike that nobody is talking about because half of the people don't even know that they exist. And a lot of times within the movement space, we've been talking about, you know, martyrs, right, and what people are willing to put on the line for the cause. We don't need martyrs. We've already got enough dead bodies. We don't need any more. So ensuring that we continue to remember their humanity and ensure that their deaths were not in vain is critical. I think that you will see in the coming months, again, to that notion of people power, the people know who they are. We are not willing to forget, and we're not willing to let anyone else forget. And so there have been, sometimes quietly, pushes for accountability in St. Louis City and St. Louis County for those other lives that have been lost. But I think this is fundamentally a question of humanity. And I think, Tiffany, it goes back to your question. So when I was a teacher in Southeast Washington, D.C., I lived 10 minutes from my school. And there were lots of colleagues that I had that were teaching all over the city who would live in the gentrified neighborhoods and then drive 20 or 30 minutes to their school in urban areas. And I lived 10 minutes from my school on purpose because I wanted my kids' grocery store to be my grocery store. I wanted my kids' parents' post offices to be my post office. I wanted to bump into my students' parents everywhere that I went. If there was a shooting in the neighborhood, I knew about it, right? If there was injustice in that place, that it was also injustice that I was experiencing. So that every single time I encountered a young person in my community, I knew that they were one of mine and that whatever was affecting them was affecting me. And until we actually get to the place and require our law enforcement to be in the place where they understand their fate to be tied up with everyone else's around them, we're not going to make real progress. So I actually think that that really should be a requirement of operating in the law enforcement space, and it should be a requirement really of all public officials, because if you have the power to come in and take life in my community, you had better see these lives as your own, because you live here and you're invested in this place, and you don't look at my kids and see thugs, you look at my kids and see human beings.
Although, you know, Brittany, kids are terrified when they see their teacher in the grocery store. They go, that's Miss Pettnett! That's Miss Pettnett!
But it was the perfect time to check and see if that homework was done.
That's right. One more question on Twitter before we go to our closing thoughts. Stephen Robin using the hashtag Beyond Ferguson. And remember, the hashtag lives even after we leave this space, so continue the conversation. And what are milestones that the panelists would like to see reached? And by when? Dre, I'm going to, yes, yes, you, milestone.
You know, I'm interested in a disbanded police department. We made a website called protesttoprogress.org that actually, like, logs a lot of the smaller things that have happened in a timeline so people can just see that there have been a lot of small wins already. A disbanded PD, you know, I'm excited for Mayor Knowles to be recalled or resigned or fired or any combination of those three. And I'm also interested in, like, the other six, right? So, like, Isaac, Antonio, Von Derek, Kajim, Ladarius, and Thomas, the other people who have been killed, we know nothing about them. So, like, in a very simple way, like, I want an update on where their investigations are. And I was there the night that the officers got shot. And the turnaround time on that investigation was incredible. And, like, I'm sitting here, like, you know, they killed Kajim, like, 9 days after Mike Brown. And, like, where is that investigation? Like, let me know. And that was on camera. So, like, so I'm interested in those sort of small but important milestones.
Anyone else want to speak on that? Okay, then we're going to go into our closing thoughts. I want to thank everyone here in this audience. I know that you have a lot of places you could be tonight. We keep hearing about Ferguson fatigue, but you're not fatigued. So I want to thank all of you who came out this evening. I want to thank, of course, my colleagues at St. Louis Public Radio for hosting this evening and for doing their important work. I'm going to ask each of our panelists to give us a closing final thought. I'm going to end with Reverend Johnson because you are the host of our event and you opened your church to us once again so that we could have this important conversation. Why don't we take turns? So, Rich McClure, I'm going to give you a closing thought and then we'll go to Dre McKesson.
I'll return to one of the questions on the table earlier, and I think the answer is this is both relational and issues of the heart and their systemic issues. And I think they're interconnected. You know, our governmental systems and our policymaking systems come from people. And so I think we have to both hold systems accountable and hold ourselves accountable. And so I think whether it's living in our own bubbles that we've heard talked about this evening, or whether it's calling for changes at the policy level, whether it's coming from municipalities or from police departments or from the legislature or the county council or the board of aldermen or civic organizations or not-for-profit involvement, that we need to be intentional about both and not rely on one or the other to create those milestones, because it will take both, and it will take long-term, intentional, thoughtful walking together arm in arm. Even if we don't see eye to eye on every issue, we will see eye to eye on many issues, and that will create positive change.
Has this process changed you? Has being part of this commission changed you in any way that
I
you can share?
Yes, it has. And I think our entire community has been changed in one way or another. And I think that we need to understand that the tragedies of these events should engender in all of us an intention to change. And certainly that's been true for me.
Rich McClure, thank you. The co-chair of the Ferguson Commission, thank you for coming. Dre McKesson, closing thought?
I'll say four things quickly. And again, I love Twitter, so these would be like in tweet thoughts. So the first is this idea that, like, love sustains this space. So, like, yes, we are angry, but angry doesn't sustain a movement for 200 days. Love does. Like, people are out because they love blackness, they love justice, they love the people who've been killed so much that they refuse to go home. The second is this idea that protest is disruption, protest is confrontation, protest is the end of silence. Protest is not always physical. And I think people get enthralled by the shutdown the mall and the shutdown the street, and that is important, and that is a necessary continuing part of protest. But protest is confronting the way people think too. And that work has to happen. So, like, if you cannot be in the street, it does not mean that you are not a protester. It just means that you are protesting differently. The third is one of the things that I think has always, for me, been the most important thing about this space is the origin story. That, like, this started because, like, regular people came outside and said enough is enough. It wasn't a Martin. It wasn't a Malcolm. It wasn't an NAACP. It wasn't the Urban League. It was, like, people. And, like, that is just so powerful. It, like, reminds you that you are enough to start a movement, that, like, you have agency and voice. And I think I don't know anything more powerful than that. And then the last thing I'll say is that the trauma is still present. So I think about the night of the shooting is that Belmar immediately, like, I was there, the police tape wasn't even up yet, and I'm getting tweets being like, Belmar said the shooter is embedded in the protest community. And I'm parked at the bottom of Tiffin, right? I'm right there, so I can't see him. I can see that, like, he was at least 500 feet away from where the police officers were because I was there. So for Belmar to make the statement that he was embedded and that the police were ambushed is like a reminder of why we fight. It's like a reminder of what it means that prejudicial policing, like, manifests both in the way that we are killed but in the way that we are spoken about. And then he retracts it and he, like, does all these verbal backflips. But, like, he knew that it was important that his initial statement was a lie.
Why do you think that is, that there was a desire to Because I heard someone else in another interview on CNN say that this was a person who was a part of the protest movement. Why do you think that was an important message to...
From him?
Yeah, from him. Why? What was that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, you know, I think Belmar is like the war general of Missouri, right? Like, he is, like, excited to tear gas. I think they want us to go home. He's trying to discredit us. And, like, we can't be, like, hold the system accountable and not be accountable ourselves. I get that, right? I get that, like, there has to be some sort of accountability across the board. But I also get that, like, you at the very least need to tell the truth, right? Like, the police at the very least have to tell the truth. So, like, when we're 200 days in and you still lie, it's like, I mean, that is crazy to me. Like, that is wild that you would do that. And then you try and do, and then McCullough comes out and does the press conference because, like, you know, he didn't say the lie. He's lied about many other things, but he didn't lie about that. Then we don't even see Belmar again. And, like, and it's like the subtle ways that, like, the trauma is still present that we have not forgotten.
Is there anything that you or on behalf of the other people in the movement should apologize for? Is there anything you regret?
Those are different questions.
Is there anything that you regret, and is there anything that you wish to apologize for yourself?
Here's what I'll say is that there is pain in blackness and there's trauma in it. And the way the pain manifests looks different for different people. The way that I would sort of remind people is that this has been, I am frustrated by how many times we have to remind people that we're peaceful. Not only because, like, we have been peaceful, but because, like, nobody's asking the police to peacefully police, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's asking the police for the same sort of, like, tell me how peaceful you are. So I get worried about that.
You don't think the Department of Justice report does that?
No, and I appreciate the Department of Justice. I will say that it was the same department that cannot get them to wear badges, right? So I'm not, like, blinded by that. That, like, the night of the shooting, there was an officer from Bellevue with no nameplate. So I'm interested to see what the DOJ does, if anything, right? Because when they said wear badges, that didn't work.
5 years from now, where do you hope to be?
Home, not worried about the police killing people.
Okay. Duray McKesson, a name and a face known to many of you now, who changed his life to come to live in this community and to do this work. Thank you for coming as well. Brittany?
I think my closing thought really is a charge. So I think that the fundamental power of what we have seen over the last 227 days since August 9th is that the world has been forced to acknowledge, and even beyond the world, right, the people that we live next door to and the folks across town and the people that had spent all of their time busying themselves with ignoring the plight of other human beings, that all of these folks have been forced to acknowledge that marginalized people, and in particular, black people, are human too, that we bleed too, that our pain is real too, that we have dreams for our children too, and that, quite frankly, our anger and rage and frustration is justified historically. And in acknowledging that, I am thankful for a time where black people in particular and our allies that have been courageous enough to stand up with us are saying that you have to be okay dealing with this now. You no longer get to want to run away from black pain. You no longer get to run away from black rage. You don't get to ignore it because you're uncomfortable by it, right? That you're going to deal, because we've been dealing living like this for our whole lives, so you're going to deal with our expression of it. And so from there, I really am hopeful that that manifests into our stories being valid enough to not need reports and commissions and task forces, because the people of North County, where I'm a native of North County, we've been telling these stories for years. And it took statistics and data and research and months and months and months for people to actually find valid the stories of people of color, right? That I actually want to see us dealing with marginalization so clearly that we acknowledge the validity of people when they tell you a story that is their truth, right? That I want to see it manifest such that hopefully we never have another name, but when we will, that immediately we do not go into digging into the victim's past, right, and the victims criminalizing the victim and actually blaming them for their own death. I want to get to the point where folks are no longer looking at the students that we serve in this area, the children that I feel like all belong to me, as less than human, because that is exactly what has gotten us into this situation. And I want people to look at my kids and see lives that are as valuable as their own. And so the charge that I have is that people need to center themselves in the discomfort of that pain, right? Whether or not you actually have to, right? If you bear white skin and you have the privilege to escape that pain, I want you to let go of that privilege and center yourselves in our pain anyway. Because in order to actually shift, in order to actually make a change, it will require your discomfort. It will require you to relinquish your power and privilege. And that's the only way to really truly stand in solidarity with us. And that if you do that, that the students that look up at me and ask, am I next? I need for your answer to be not on my watch. Not as long as I have breath in my body. Not as long as I'm a citizen of this city, this state, this country. I need for you to make that promise to them just as you would want somebody to make that promise to your own child.
Brittany Packnett, the Executive Director of Teach for America in St. Louis and also a member of the Ferguson Commission. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, your closing thought?
Well, I want to approach this from a very personal perspective. One, I want to say that there is a tie that binds all of us. Our lives are all interwoven. We can't escape the fact that we're all one piece of fabric, all of us. We're tied. But I also want to say that as someone who has an appreciation for democracy and for the law, whether we like the law or we don't, it is so discouraging that so many people have no clue, no inkling of how hard we are fighting in Jefferson City, our state capital. What we have to endure, the reason why I was out on August 9th is because 14 years prior to that, I was also a victim of the system called state government. And I didn't want one other child to ever have to go through or endure what it's like to be discriminated against, to be questioned, to be validated. For so many years, for so many people, that happens every single day. We not only need to tear down this system in Ferguson, in the St. Louis region, there is also a wall that we need to tear down in our state capitol. There are four bills that I have sponsored, and I don't know who in this room knows too. You know, it's important to be an interpreter, but you need more interpreters. You can't have one interpreter. You can't have, while we all have a space, a place, and a role, we have to have people who are willing to cross over, to go from the streets to the state capitol, to go from the state capitol to the streets. Right now, I think I have more legislators who are going to the streets than people in the streets going to the legislature, and that upsets me. But this is what I signed up for. This is the role, this is the responsibility. This is the accountability that I have to answer to every day. And I believe that the most important thing that any of us, I don't care what your background is. I don't care if you're white. I don't care if you're black. I don't care if you are Asian. What ties us is our education and our pursuit to be better people. We all have to pursue being better than what we are today. Every generation, I think every parent would say, we want the next generation to be greater than what we are. It is so important that we focus on the education of police officers. That's a no-brainer. Of young people and people who recognize that the system has failed. But it is so hard to do that in isolation, to do that without having that structure, that same energy that's on the streets in the Capitol, where there are people, most people don't look like you. There are 3 African-American state senators out of 34. There are 5 women senators out of 34. Think about that uphill battle. It's okay, though, because we're willing to take on that. But it would be so nice to have a committee hearing where there are not 2 people that show up who experience the tear gassing, but 100 people who show up to articulate the violent acts that have occurred and why the system needs to be torn down in order to make systematic changes, in part that happens not here in Ferguson, that happens in Jefferson City. Yes, everyone has a space, a place, and a role, but if we are not engaging with everyone to make sure that all our bases are covered, What does it mean? How much longer will it take to recover from this injury that has been allowed to exist for decades on end? Who is willing to own that responsibility of not doing enough?
State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, thank you so much for joining us. Chris Kramer.
My organization believes in the premise that community building happens at the speed of trust. And trust is a function of being in relationship and being in relationship over time. And if we're going to address the multitude of challenges that we face in our communities today, like housing and education and jobs and health and economic development, you have to focus on all those things together. Tonight we've talked about a whole lot of important issues that sprang out of the tragic event and subsequent events that have happened to many folks in this region. If we're going to tackle a lot of the underlying issues that are there, we have to, again, believe in what Dr. King said when he said the long arc of a moral universe bends toward justice. It's clear that arc is not bending fast enough and quick enough because there's not enough of us who are saying we have to provide justice in our community. We have to provide hope and opportunity for the children of our community. And we know how to do all these things, right? We know how to teach our children. We know how to develop housing. We know how to provide health care for folks. We've chosen not to do that for everybody in our community. And if we have the collective courage to say, look, we can do this. We know how to do this. Do we care enough? Do we give a damn enough? And when we compel those who have the levers of power to move in that direction, then guess what? We can get this done. So if you leave here tonight, please note that everything that we've talked about here is indeed possible, is indeed achievable, if we collectively have the courage to do the things that are necessary. And yes, it's about you in this big, beautiful house that we're in, but it's you then going out and telling lots of other folks that the things that are happening in our community are just not acceptable. And you know what? They're achievable. They're solvable. We have to have the courage to get it done.
Chris Kramer, thank you so much. All right. Reverend Johnson, this is your house. And thank you once again to the Wellspring community for welcoming this group here once again. Thank you. Reverend Johnson, final thought from you.
As always, we thank you. You have allowed us to come together and not only share, but to listen. And out of that, we're reminded that we still have promises to keep, and we still have many more miles to go before we sleep.
Reverend Willis Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. And thank all of you.
I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and you've been listening to Ferguson and Beyond, continuing the community conversation, recorded on Monday night at Wellspring Church in Ferguson. This has been a special production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.